Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 869 in Isleta Pueblo, I'm Tara Gatewood. Clara Pratt worked on the political campaigns of Joe Biden and Jonathan Nez of the Navajo Nation. She's worked in Washington at the Department of Commerce and built her own economic development consulting business. But she's also waitressed at a truck stop and managed a Target store. She recently won the 2020 Emerging Environmental Genius Award. Pratt is our native in the spotlight. We'll talk with her right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The roll call vote to impeach President Trump among the six indigenous U.S. lawmakers was split down the middle on party lines. Republican representatives from Oklahoma, Tom Cole and Mark Wayne Mullen, and New Mexico's Yvette Harrell voted no, while Democrats Sharice Davids of Kansas, Deb Holland of New Mexico, and Kai Kahele of Hawaii voted yes to impeach Trump for high crimes and misdemeanors following last week's deadly riot at the Capitol. The article of impeachment states Trump incited an insurrection against the government of the United States. A trial now moves to the Senate. President Trump released a 5-minute video message Wednesday to the public condemning violence, but he did not mention the impeachment. Washington State's Commissioner of Public Lands is calling for state lawmakers to approve a new bill that would provide dedicated funding to help battle wildfires and at the same time improve forest health. Steve Jackson reports.
The bill calls for spending $125 million each biennium to fund new firefighters and new aircraft. The funding would also speed up the current forest health plan that seeks to ensure wildfire resistance on 1.25 million acres of forest and invest in defensive strategies at the community level, like direct assistance to homeowners to secure their property. Colville Tribal Chairman Rodney Costin is one supporter of the bill.
I always say that we're the poster child for climate change here on the Caldwell Reservation. We've experienced pretty much every natural disaster you can imagine in the last 5 to 10 years. These additional resources are what we really need, you know, and I hope we don't have another fire season like we did this last summer. But in the event that, you know, we do, that we'll be much better prepared.
In September, 5 major wildfires burned on the Caldwell Reservation simultaneously, destroying 80 homes, killing livestock, and destroying hundreds of power lines and thousands of acres of commercial forest. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
A tribal group is suing the Trump administration to stop a land exchange on the Tonto National Forest in Arizona, saying the plan to greenlight one of the largest copper mines in the country threatens a sacred site. KNAU's Ryan Heinches reports.
The group Apache Stronghold says the federal government is violating the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and the San Carlos Apache Tribe's constitutional rights to religious freedom and due process. They argue the Oak Flat area can't be legally transferred to the international mining company Rio Tinto because it was set aside for the Apache people in an 1852 treaty. On Friday, the U.S. Forest Service plans to publish the final environmental impact statement for the Resolution Copper Mine, which would begin the land swap process. Apache Stronghold says the Forest Service is fast-tracking publication of the statement before President Trump leaves office next week. The Forest Service has said it's not rushing the process, and work on the land transfer took less time than anticipated. The agency didn't immediately comment on the lawsuit. Rio Tinto says it's committed to protecting Native American cultural heritage while diversifying the local economy. Oak Flat is sacred to the San Carlos Apache, who've conducted coming-of-age and other ceremonies at the site for centuries. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The Navajo Nation Wednesday announced a $10 million settlement with mining companies for claims they created conditions, which led to the 2015 Gold King Mine spill when millions of gallons of toxic waste flowed into waterways traveling through Navajo land. Claims against contractors and the U.S. government are pending, as well as hundreds of claims from individual Navajo citizens. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Now, National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
For Native Americans affected by domestic violence, the Strong Hearts Native Helpline offers peer-to-peer support and resources. It's safe, confidential, and toll-free at 844-7-NATIVE. Program support by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
If you're a Native American expanding or starting a business, the Indian Loan Guarantee and Insurance Program supports your lender so your lender can make the business loan you need. Info by emailing dci@bia.gov. The Office of Indian Energy and Economic Development supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, joining you live from my homelands of Shirvit Dui via Skype. When Clara Pratt won the Pritzker Emerging Environmental Genius Award, it came with a $100,000 prize. This Navajo entrepreneur knew exactly what the money would be used for, and it wasn't going to be a luxurious vacation to an exotic location. She's investing that money into her solar power economic development project on the Navajo Nation. She and her partners at Navajo Power aim to build a solar power plant and bring solar power to residents living off the grid. Today, we're talking with Pratt about her work in solar energy, but also her many jobs she's taken on during her career, including managing a Target store, running the campaign for the Navajo Nation president, and working with President-elect Joe Biden. She is our native in the spotlight, and if you'd like to talk to her, you can give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. It's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And joining us today from Flagstaff, Arizona, is Clara Pratt. And she is the CEO of Strongbow Strategies, and she is Navajo. Clara, my pleasure to have you here. Welcome to Native America Calling, and please feel free to further introduce yourself.
Thank you, Tara. It's an honor to be here. Thanks so much for the time. She'e Clara Pratt, and she'e Kia Ani, and she'e Lance de Lagana Bashishchin, Honorahni Dashit She'e de Lagana Dashinella, Tessa Anide An Yisin Nasha. Thank you.
Welcome into this space. Clara, you have a remarkable story, and I'm glad you are here to share it with us today on this program. And Clara, let's talk about where you grew up, how things started. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I grew up on the Navajo Nation in a little community known as Tessa'ane or Lupton, Arizona. It's right on the New Mexico-Arizona border, which made for interesting time change issues when half the household would be on Mountain Standard and the rest of the household on Mountain Daylight Time. But yes, it's where I grew up, right there on the border of New Mexico-Arizona on the nation. The community is relatively small, and I grew up on the south side of Lupton, which is connected only by a very old Army Corps of Engineers bridge that was probably built in the 40s or something like that. It's currently closed right now, and it for a long overdue replacement that first started my interest in public advocacy as a young child. But yes, no running water, no electricity. Very much in tune with the land. We had livestock, like so many folks. My grandparents had sheep and grew up herding sheep and riding the rams when we weren't supposed to and getting in trouble for that. But it was a wonderful growing up period. It just so much vast space, and it was like having a giant playground all the time.
Beautiful. I know some of you know exactly what that means. And we are talking with Clara Pratt. Thanks for joining us today. And if you'd like to talk with her direct, call in 1-800-996-2848. And Clara, tell me a little bit about some of your schooling. Where did you go to school? Did you like it? Some of your favorite subjects?
You know, I loved school as a child. I started school fairly early because I learned to read so early. And so my parents thought maybe it was a good idea to go ahead and enroll me in school. And my father is non-native and my mom is Navajo. And you know, unfortunately, they didn't have the greatest relationship, and they ended up divorcing when I was relatively young. And because of my father's issues that he had, I ended up living with my mother, full time. So I didn't grow up, in my father's household and didn't visit with him very often. But it was, it was a troubled childhood, I would say. But being surrounded by family, growing up on the nation, gave me a lot of confidence and support. My mom is one of 12 children, so I had a lot of mayajes and jayajes, aunties and uncles and cousins that I grew up with. So I would say my schooling didn't get off to a great start because of so many issues related to having a turbulent childhood and that sort of thing. But as I grew and got a little bit more confident, I went to Gallup Public Schools in New Mexico. Around the eighth grade, my mom said, you know, I'm getting really nervous about the state of affairs going on here and some of the people that you're hanging around with. And she said, you know, I'm going to send you to live with your aunt in Flagstaff. So she sent me to live with my aunt and my uncle in Flagstaff, and better school system, better opportunities, she thought. But as luck or no luck would have it, my aunt and her husband ended up having to move back to the nation. So I ended up in Flagstaff by myself. And, you know, it was interesting because I don't know kind of how this unfolded, but I just know that I was obstinate about wanting to stay in Flagstaff for this opportunity. So I ended up living here by myself and going to school here. And so, you know, at 15, leaving the nest and being on my own, it's interesting to kind of look at it in retrospect and say, gosh, at the time it seemed to make a lot of sense. But now I look at people of that age and I think, how on earth did I do that? How on earth did I work a job and pay utility bills and all that sort of thing at 15 years old and go to school in the daytime? But somehow I managed.
And Clara, for you, if you can remember those times, what was it that pushed you through all of this? Was it priority to school, wanting to make a path for yourself? Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. I don't know if it was a priority for school per se. It was more of wanting to prove people wrong. I think it was a little bit of stubbornness, a little bit of wanting to say, look, I can do this. I can do it on my own. I don't need anybody. And, you know, to a certain extent, I'm still very much like that, sometimes to my detriment. But it was definitely wanting to prove to people that I could do it and that people like me could do it, that we could be self-sufficient and we could hold our own even at that age, and wanting to make a path for myself. And I remember trying to figure out how was I going to make a living. And, you know, when you get your electricity shut off and you have no way to pay your utility bills and you resort to selling your clothes and your music CDs, because at that time you could go and, you know, do consignment and sell CDs for, you know, a couple bucks here and there. Those $20 bills start to look really, really good and really enticing when you try to figure out how to make your way. So, you know, it was a survival instinct, I think, and not a little bit of pride and stubbornness.
Wow. And, you know, it's amazing to think of the things we go through in our younger life and then take that look back. And you doing that now, wonder if it's inspiring anyone to think of their own path and the things you've overcome and how it got you to where you are right now. Share your thoughts, 1-800-996-2848. And Clara, tell us a little bit about the work and your college story. Go ahead.
Sure. So I started at NAU. I was here in Flagstaff, and I wasn't really quite sure what I wanted to do with my life. You know, at that point, I had been on my own for a few years then. And it was interesting because going to college, it was like everybody was just now experiencing what it was like to be away from home, and I had already been doing it for some time. So I felt a little bit ahead of the curve in that respect. Nothing grabbed me. I remember taking the core courses and nothing spoke to me. So I took a cross country trip in a car, a Geo Metro, a teeny tiny little tin can, and decided to just drive across the United States somewhat irresponsibly, but very, very educational, and drove from Arizona to Massachusetts, back up north through Canada, back down and cut back down through Yellowstone, camped out a lot, you know. It was a good kind of eye-opening experience of different places, different people, different cultures, and really the first time I'd ever been away. And from that point, I moved back home, moved back to the reservation, and ended up going to the UNM Gallup branch. And I really was inspired by the students, by the teachers. It was a much smaller class size than NAU, and there were Navajos there, right? So it felt very comfortable, and just really, I liked it. I liked the experience. But I also started waitressing at the same truck stop that my mom started her journey at, and where she retired from. You know, she worked at the same truck stop and for many years of her life, right there on the border. So I started working there. I liked that. I liked meeting all sorts of people from all sorts of walks of life. And I was really good at being a waitress. And I figured, you know, this is as good a path as any. So I'm gonna waitress, and I'm gonna make lots of good tips, and that's that. And I'll get a double wide here on the reservation, and life will be good. And, you know, maybe I'll meet somebody and have a bunch of kids and have some horses and goats and what have you. And I think my mom wisely, she kicked me out for the second time. So I think it was like, you know, the only person that I know of that's been kicked out twice from home for my own good. She said, you know, you're getting too comfortable. You need to go to school. You need to go figure something out, and it's not here. So I applied to a couple schools, and I applied to University of Arizona, and I watched a movie, and I can't remember what movie it was, but it was about some young woman who goes to school to become an ad executive. And I thought, well, that looks like fun. I'm going to apply to the business school. Like, what a whim, you know, to apply to a business school on. But I did it, and I got into the Eller College. And so I moved to Tucson and went through that process, which was very, it was difficult. I mean, you're all these weeder courses that are really set up to weed out people, and made it through.
Knowing that, you know, you kept on this educational journey, and I keep hearing from you, these are decisions you made by living your life. And it's really interesting to just think about what our decisions lead to. You'll hear what more of Clara's decisions led to coming up after the break, as we hear more about her journey in life, as well as fulfilling her own dreams. You can join us too. 1-800-996-2848 is a number. Among the books by Native authors published in 2020, there were children's books about water protectors and res dogs. And there were fictional thrillers about crimes on reservations. On the next Native America Calling, we'll talk with two literature experts about which books made it to the top of their best of list. We hope you can join us.
If you're hurting in your relationship and want to talk, Strong Hearts Native Helpline is a confidential and anonymous domestic violence helpline for Native Americans, available at 1-844-762-8483, or connect with a live advocate by using the Chat Now button at strongheartshelpline.org. Advocates offer support and referrals for resources daily, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Central Time. This program supported by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Mesleta Pueblo, and we are talking with our January Native in the Spotlight, Clara Pratt. She is Navajo and focuses on tribal economic development. And if you'd like to chat with her or ask her a question, you can give us a call. The number to join us is 1-800-996-2848. She joins us today out of Flagstaff, Arizona. And Clara, you were telling us a little bit more about, I guess, the beginning of getting bit by the business bug. Tell me more.
Yes. So, you know, I went to business school and thought it was great. Really enjoyed it. And there's, I think, part of what drove me to sort of figuring that out is seeing the relationship between my mother and my father, and just how economically devastating their divorce was, and just never wanting to be in a position of dependency. She's a domestic violence survivor, and it was very traumatic for her to go through helping him build his dreams and his business you know, and having him be so abusive. So she made the decision to leave, and, you know, much to her, you know, economic downfall, if you will. And I see that a lot with lots of women across the country that end up in so few words, destitute, you know, not having a lot and having children to care for. So the drive to go to business wasn't so much a, oh, I think I'd be really good at accounting or marketing. It was more of what's going to make me economically independent. So, you know, going to business school was a part of that. After I finished business school, I ended up running a Target in Oro Valley and joining Target Corporation. And I liked that. You know, it was fun, and it was it was grueling work. You go in, you open the store at like 5 o'clock in the morning, make sure everything's running, and then you come in, you close the store at closing. It's hard work, stocking and all those sorts of things. But my last year of college before I went to work for Target Corporation, I took a public policy course, and that was under Dr. Neil Vance at the University of Arizona. And it was just an elective, nothing that I had thought would be anything that would change my life, so to speak. But it was one course that changed my life. And he's an expert on criminal justice and public policy. And so I took his course and fell in love with all of it. And ended up doing a research paper on the criminal justice system and incarceration of Natives specifically, and the inequities of incarceration rates of Native men, and the impact that has, the ripple effect that has throughout communities. And it was so fascinating. So, you know, did that paper and really had a great connection with Dr. Vance, who encouraged me to apply to public policy school, including at the U of A. And he said, you know, I really think you should apply to some of these other top schools in the country. And I said, well, I'm not a public policy person. He said, yes, but you have a gift for this. You should do this. So I applied to some of the top programs thinking, okay, well, you know, U of A might offer me a great position. I'm already here in Tucson. I'll do that. And I'll stay a broke student for a few years longer to explore this. But lo and behold, I remember coming home to my teeny tiny little studio apartment on the south side of Tucson, and there was a package on my front door, and it was from Carnegie Mellon. And I was like, what is this? And I opened it up, and it was all this Pittsburgh stuff, you know, like Pittsburgh things from Pittsburgh, all food and snacks. And it said, we'd love for you to come. So I made a decision to move to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I had never been before. To go to the public policy school there. And I guess that's kind of how I ended up doing a nexus between business and policy.
And what were some of the things that just started making sense for you, especially applying that to your own community or your nation?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a lot of communities, tribal as well as non-tribal, really do have an insurmountable amount of things to overcome in order to economically develop, if you will. And I was lucky enough to live in a really rough area of Pittsburgh. And I say lucky because the experience of the people there in East Liberty really resonated with me. And there were also displaced people from downtown Pittsburgh that were moved to these government-created ghettos of projects. And it echoed to me this movement of people, this forceful movement of people, this breaking up of community, what happens and what has happened in Indian country. Again, you're talking about an urban versus rural kind of, you know, existence, but the results are the same. Health disparities, domestic violence, substance abuse, and all of these things that I had seen growing up in a very real way happening to populations across the United States, whether it was tribal or non-tribal. And it started to click for me when you were talking about policies and the policies that we implement. We had to research GAO reports, delve into GAO reports of very specific policies, and you start to see how the system is set up and how it can be rigged against communities of color, particularly, and you know, going further into that, into more marginalized communities and women of color. So it really started to click for me that, you know, the anomaly of being successful as a color, as a woman of color, in business or in policy, you've had to overcome so many different hurdles just to get to that point. And why is that? Why isn't the playing field equal? And how do you create equity in a space where equity is not the norm? And that got me excited about doing something that could not just impact me and myself and my own family, my own income, but creating a system that could support generational wealth. And I use the term wealth in a sort of loose way because it doesn't always mean monetary wealth. You know, wealth can refer to culture, language, subsistence living, things that are important to us as Native people, being wealthy in that way. Because, you know, growing up the way I did, I never thought of myself as not being wealthy because I had so much in terms of family and culture and language. It never occurred to me that we were broke or we were poor. We were, but it just didn't feel that way. And I think that's because of the strong fabric of identity and language and family. And when you have that breakdown of those pieces of wealth along with monetary wealth, that's when you really have some of the more devastating impacts that affect our communities.
And you have definitely, and you've even shared this with others, of the reality of creating equity, things that are really sustainable in our Native communities, and also understanding culture plays a big role in all of that too. And so, Clara, before we move into more of some exciting things you've put on your own path and help open up, Clara, any message to students just hearing your story today of keep pushing through all of it?
Yeah, I would say don't give up. Don't give up no matter what. I mean, there were several times when I just said, I'm not cut out for this. I'm not smart enough. I can't do this. I don't have the money. I don't have the anything, but just keep pushing. And, you know, it does get better. Oddly enough, you keep pushing through what seems so difficult, and the rewards are so great.
They truly are, and especially some of the things that you've been able to do. Let's talk about some of them. Politics. You definitely made headlines being asked to be on presidential campaign, part of the team. Go ahead and tell me a little bit about how you connected with the Biden-Harris campaign.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I'm, you know, just living my life, being a mom and running Strongbow and doing the Navajo Power stuff. And I was contacted by some former colleagues, and I had been an appointee under President Obama at the Small Business Administration. And they called and said, look, we really need somebody to run Native outreach for the campaign. And I said, well, you know, I've got 10 other things on my plate right now. Let me give you some names. So I gave them a bunch of names. So they came back and they said, could you do it? You know, and I thought really long and hard about it. And my husband, who's an attorney in Indian country, is, you know, he's busy as well. And of course, with the pandemic, we have two small ones at home. It seems just not possible. But we thought about it, and I really wanted to be a part of making history. And I thought, well, let me talk to my business colleagues and talk to them and say, this is what I'm thinking about doing. Can we shift some workload? And my partner on Strongbow said, sure, we can do it. My partners at Navajo Power said, sure, we can do it. My husband, God bless him, said, yeah, we'll figure it out. And then my mom moved in from the Navajo Nation to help me just manage, because campaigns are 24/7. And I said yes. And just from one day to the next, it was just like drinking from a fire hose. All systems go all the time to change history and to make sure we elected President-elect Biden. And we did even better than I could have fathomed with turning Arizona blue, and just working with a group of fabulous people on the ground and also throughout the country.
And so the Native vote really came through in many places, what I'm hearing from different advocates. And what are some of the lessons you learned, Clara, about the power of the Native vote?
The power of the Native vote has been widely underestimated for a very long time. And I think this election has shown outsiders what can be done in places where there's high Native population. If you just invest the time, the energy, and the dollars to making sure they hear the message and making sure they're part of the conversation. The other thing that was really challenging about this campaign is because of the pandemic, we had to do most of it remotely. I sat in the same chair that I'm calling you from now and did most of the campaigning from here, some limited engagement external when things were safe enough to do so. But what it really taught was you have to invest the resources. You can't pay lip service to Native communities. You have to actually have policies to back up what you're saying. And you have to take action, and you have to engage, and talk a lot and put people on the ground. We had, for the Biden campaign, we had so many organizers on the ground. I think in Arizona alone, we had 20-some-odd just for the Biden campaign, not counting the county Dems and the Arizona Dems and all of that stuff. So it was a huge investment.
And so as we are in the times we are with the vote being scrutinized, what are some of your thoughts, especially thinking of all the work you put into it?
Well, it's irritating to say the least, because, you know, that work is really hard, and you know that it's valid, and you know the results are valid, and you see the division that has come about, and especially in the last 2 weeks. But the division has always been there. There's a huge divide, and certainly felt that during the campaign itself. And being in a red state, although Flagstaff is relatively blue, going and campaigning in more conservative-leaning areas and districts, the country is divided. And a lot of blame-placing and finger-pointing, and not a lot of dialogue or consensus creating. And I think about, you know, the last 20 years of political activity and how much more divided it has come along. I mean, there's no such thing as bipartisanship anymore, it seems. It's sad. It is sad. And I'm hopeful that there can be some reconciliation. And that's my biggest hope, is that there's reconciliation. Because I think all of us have friends and family that we know from different points of view. I certainly know people that were adamant Trump supporters. I know people that were adamant Bernie supporters, you know, and there has to be a coming together of the minds for the unification of the country.
And yes, this is something that is weighing huge on so many levels, and we are going to dive deeper into that, you know, in the coming week. And Clara, you had a direct connection to the person, you know, will be sitting in the Oval Office. Clara, your thoughts, and did you have direct contact with Biden? Any conversations you'd like to relive with us?
You know, I was fortunate to meet with the president-elect and the vice president-elect in Arizona when he and Senator Harris came to visit with tribal leaders. And, you know, of course, had not, you know, one-on-one interactions with him during my time as an Obama appointee, but certainly know his character and his staff and those sorts of folks. And I'll say a couple of things that really touched my heart during that meeting. The first is they walk in, and there's, of course, a huge entourage of security and staff and whoever else. And I'm sitting there with the tribal leaders, and we had them go one by one and meet and visit with him. And the first tribal leader stood up and said, "Thank you so much for coming and visiting us. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here." And was just really grateful that he was there and that Senator Harris was there. And President-elect Biden said, no, thank you. Thank you for allowing me to be here on your tribal homelands and for allowing me to meet with you as tribal leaders and leaders of your nations." That just really struck my heart, because it's something that I don't think a lot of people would have an understanding, that he has a very innate understanding about tribal sovereignty and the nation-to-nation relationship. So that was very exciting and very touching. at the end of that meeting, another tribal leader said, "I'd like to send you off with a prayer song, if that's okay." And he said, "Of course, we'd love that." And he sang a prayer song for him, and he was visibly moved by that. And it was an eagle song, sung by Chairman Norris of Tohono O'odham Nation. And he was visibly moved, and he was kind of dabbing at his eye, and he said, "You know, my son, the past, we would sit and talk for a long time at this one particular place outdoors near a lake. And after he passed, I went there, and this pair of eagles came down and flew near me. And I felt a sense of calm at that point in time, and that's what that song reminded me of." So it was just a very touching moment, and I just have a great deal of confidence in the administration, the soon-to-be administration, and the people that we have chosen to put in very critical roles, not least of whom is, you know, Congresswoman Holland from Mexico, who will be leading Interior. But just that level of representation and the individuals that have care and understanding and cultural fluency is going to be phenomenal. And I'm just very excited.
In the priorities that are also being set, I want to get your take on that as well. But if you'd like to talk with Clara, now is the time. Dial in 1-800-996-2848. She is our Native in the Spotlight. And coming up after the break, we'll also hear her work and hopes for opening up the solar power industry and being a Native-led business. If you want to talk to her again, give us a ring. 1-800-996-2848 is a number. And maybe you have some questions. You're hearing her story and you know she'd be giving you some good insight. Dial in. Phone lines are open.
Support by the Association of American Indian Physicians and the SAMHSA-sponsored Opioid Response Network, working with tribal communities across the nation to address the opioid crisis. Breaking the cycle starts with preventing opioid misuse, treating opioid use disorder with medications and counseling, and recovery support during all phases of recovery. If you or a loved one is challenged by opioid use disorder, you can find additional information at aaip.org.
Thanks for joining us today here on Native America Calling. And there is still time left in our program. If you'd like to talk with Clara Pratt, she is our Native in the Spotlight for January. And the number to get you into the conversation is 1-800-996-2848. And Clara, when we think of what we are hearing from the Joe Biden camp about priorities set to connect with our Native nations, tell me a little bit about what you are hearing from them and the possibilities.
Sure. There are a number of tribal priorities that were thrust out during the campaign. Some of the highlights are reaffirming the consultation policies, making sure that tribes are consulted with early, often, ongoing during any sort of federal nexus. The other thing is making sure that they are involved in the environmental justice portfolio of work that will be undertaken under this current administration, which includes the 30 by 30 plan, reducing emissions by 30%, 30 years, and going renewable. So there's a variety of tribal nation-to-nation pieces that are really important for restoring that relationship and that integrity between the federal government and our independent tribal nations. But there's also a piece on racial equity to ensure that not only tribal governments are represented well by their elected leaders, but that individual Native people are also not left out of that conversation. So when you're talking on things of particular interest to me that, you know, are at the top of my mind are the renewable energy items, as well as the economic development items, to ensure that Native-owned small businesses have access to capital, to credit, to technical assistance, expanded access, that are afforded contracting opportunities above and beyond what's currently in place. Certainly, we're seeing movement with the Buy Indian Act so that we can actually, after 140-plus years of that bill, that act being on the books, it's finally being fully implemented. And those things really get pushed from an administration level. And then conversation changes when you have tribal members in these particular seats that are maybe tribal specific, but maybe not. So if you have tribal members in cabinet level positions like Secretary nominee Holland, if you have tribal advisors at the Department of Transportation that can speak to infrastructure needs, or HHS that can speak to not only IHS, but urban Indian healthcare systems, those things across the gamut, the conversation changes when you have personnel in place. So that's kind of one of the other big items that I know has been focused on in the last several months.
And tell me about being a part of the transition team.
There's not too much to tell. It's just it's kind of a continuation of the work we did on the campaign, except just transitioning into formal government. So a lot of listening to external stakeholders and listening to internal stakeholders within the government on different projects and priorities, so that there is a smooth transfer of power, which we've had in this country forever. Since the foundation of the government, the smooth transfer of power, and only now has that smooth transfer of power been called into question, which made transition work unusual, a little bit more difficult. Also, the pandemic made it more difficult, because usually you would have a transition team come in person, set up shop within an agency, a department, and you'd have a team based on interior, a team based on transportation, et cetera, energy. But since this all had to be done remotely, in some ways you could get more done because it wasn't, the building didn't close at a certain time. In other ways, it was a real challenge to have a human connection with stakeholders and current federal folks that, have a story to tell. And these are public servants that are there no matter what administration is in place. So they're there to see the programs continue to operate and be successful.
And so is there more with you and the administration, or are you starting a new chapter? Tell me more.
I'm starting, I'm going back to my old chapter. I opted to stay in Arizona and not to take a position with the administration, primarily because I've been here now for a few years. And this campaign, this election, really, really opened my eyes to the work that we have to do here at home on the home front. And of course, with Strongbow strategies, trying to build economies in that way, and the work, important work we're doing with Navajo Power, it felt like home is where I needed to be for so many reasons. And also, my children are small, and they are obsessed with their Masana, their grandmother, and just knowing language and culture and family being so important, especially at that young formative age. I want to make sure they have a real strong base of where they're from and their language and their identity. So the timing just didn't feel right at the time, but certainly, very supportive, and I'm sure we'll be still somehow involved, whether that's a board or a commission or something.
And I guess that takes us to the Pritzker Emerging Environmental Genius Award. What was that like hearing you were being awarded?
I was shocked, just completely shocked. the other candidates were so wonderful as well. And I was nominated by a colleague that we're doing some work with on the energy front. And Jamie Carlson, she's fantastic and a wonderful advocate. And she said, I'd really like to nominate you for this award. I'd never really heard of it, honestly. And this was about, a year ago. And I said, sure. Well, what can you tell me about it? And she sent me the web link. And I said, this sounds amazing. This is great. I would love to be nominated. And, even if just to be nominated is such a huge honor, you get publicity from that. I'd love that. And to draw any attention that we can to the important work we're doing with Navajo Power here on the nation. Never anticipating that I would actually make it to the three finalists, which was a shock. And then the evening of just going back and forth with this, it was all virtual, so it was all as a surprise. When they said my name, I just about fell out of my chair, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is incredible. And that award really, just highlighted the importance of energy here on the Navajo Nation and energy equity on the Navajo Nation. And one of the things that we believe in really strongly at Navajo Power is the democratization of energy. And the fact that we still have so many homes here without electricity or running water is one of the greatest travesties of my nation, and certainly how I grew up. And I just couldn't understand why. And so to be a part of that solution is really important to me.
And so what kind of projects will come specifically out of this? What will people see or your hopes to build? Tell me more.
Sure. So we have two goals with under the Navajo Power moniker. The major goal is energy equity and access, and to transfer what has been a very extractive resource dependent community, the Navajo Nation, with coal plants and coal power plants and coal mines, and to be a part of the solution of a just transition to renewables. And 10 years ago, I was in D.C. advocating to keep NGS open because I was so worried about what massive unemployment would mean for the workers there. You know, fast forward 10 years where solar is actually economically viable, which hasn't always been the case. And that's because of, you know, the lower prices of components as well as tax credits and all of these other things, and making it a little bit more attractive. And you don't replace a one-on-one job with solar. You know, you're not going to have the same number of miners or operators. But our goal is really to try to, as a public benefit corporation, to bring those benefits, those dollars that would come from a solar project, to invest those directly back into the community. So we're organized as a PBC or a public benefit corporation. And we raise capital to do these projects. And once a power purchase agreement happens from a large utility scale buyer, the funding that comes in doesn't go into our pockets. It goes into the community for essential infrastructure. So, but we're not waiting for that money to come in through a power purchase agreement to start working on those essential infrastructure pieces. While we're still pursuing the large utility scale solar and power purchase agreements and, you know, the big buzzing lines that go over people's houses, we want to make sure we're servicing the people's houses that are underneath those power lines that for many years didn't have access to that electricity that was being generated on their lands and going directly over their heads. So we also launched Navajo Power Home, which is standalone solar units for individual homes that are unable to connect into the grid for one reason or another. The money that we've gotten from the Pritzker Prize will go towards those standalone units. So we've ordered components, and we should be deploying standalone solar units to off-grid homes within the coming months. And, you know, our first batch will be about 10, and then we'll do 10 more. With $100,000, we think we can build anywhere from, you know, 15 to 20 units, which would be the first, you know, the first of what we hope to be many, many more units that we'll do under the Navajo Power Home moniker.
And Clara, does this also mean creating jobs?
Yes. So the job creation aspect will be twofold. One is training a workforce to build the units. My colleague, Brett Isaac, who's a bit of a genius, actually builds the units himself, but will be training a workforce to build the off-grid units. And then there's a whole nother construction phase that will come from the large utility scale, which is, you know, acres and acres of actual solar panels that go up. So the big economy boost from a jobs perspective is in the front end of the building. And then there are some jobs that happen on the back end with maintenance and operations and those sorts of things.
And so this is definitely diving into solving, you know, economic problems in our Native communities. And a lot of times we hear, okay, are there going to be jobs? And it also takes a certain set of skills to fulfill some of that. And things you've learned or things you've experienced or know what your family members have experienced. Is there anything you want to share about really to be successful in creating economy in our Native nations, creating jobs? Is there anything you'd like to share of critical things that need to be in place or woven into, you know, this opportunity or plan?
Absolutely. I think for tribal nations specifically, the environment has to be at least equal to or better than the external environment. we see a huge brain drain and a huge opportunity drain that happens by folks just doing the easier thing and going off reservation because it's faster, it's easier, it's more transparent. It's not an equal playing field, so to speak, on tribal lands sometimes. And I think that's one thing that really has to be in place from a policy perspective is that all players have to be held to the same standard. It has to be transparent, has to be replicatable. But it also has to be enticing. If it costs more to do business on tribal land than off tribal land, the business is going to go where water flows easiest. And I think that's been a challenge. Taxation paradigms are difficult. I think Kayenta and Tuba have some of the highest tax rates in the world, in the country at least, because of the tribal tax, state tax, township tax, et cetera. So trying to figure that out. And then from a personal perspective, I think what it takes is you can't do it alone. And, you know, I had mentioned earlier to my detriment, I can be a little bit like, I can do it myself, you know, which has not been always helpful in my life. And I think accepting that you can't do it alone, you have to have a huge network of support and knowledge base because you can't know everything. So building good teams of people, you know, like I've done with Strongbow and different folks, different perspectives bring you to the table. Like we've done with Navajo Power, diverse folks bringing different things to the table. And even in my home, you know, like I've done with my husband and having him and my mom really hold down the fort as, you know, as I was able to do some of this other stuff. And he's just been named partner at Drummond Woodson, a really great law firm that does Indian country work. And, you know, he did that despite having to be daddy daycare for many, many months, the last few months. So I think, you know, we did it by switching off and working crazy hours at different times when the children were asleep. And ours are still little. They're 2 and 3. So, you know, it does take a village of people to do an immense amount of work and push yourself to excellence. You really can't do it alone.
And so, Clara, 2021. A new calendar year, lots of possibilities. Any forecasts, thoughts, outlooks for it?
Just hope, so much hope. I know that, unfortunately, things are not going to settle down anytime soon. Politically, we're still in turbulent times. But the responsibility for each of us as individuals to take care of each other and to look out for one another supersedes all of that. So I think, you know, the parties can argue, but just treating each other as decent human beings, because we're all five-fingered beings, human beings. And we need to get back to those basics of treating each other with dignity and respect and understanding and trying to look at things from different perspectives. And I hope 2021 holds that for us as a people, as a country, that we can come together and just like, you know, ancient peoples did, find a place of understanding to move forward.
Well, thank you for that. And Clara, if folks do want to follow up with you or some of the work that you're going to be doing, where can they connect?
Sure. They can email me at cprattete. StrongbowStrategies.com.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for sharing your story with us. Really important to be able to connect and just think about where you're going to be taking things in the future. And we really appreciate you tuning in today as we visit with Clara Pratt. Clara, we wish you the best as you continue on your journey. And that's going to wrap it up for our Native in the Spotlight. But if there are folks in your community you want to tell us about that you think should be in this spotlight, we're all ears. You can always reach out, comments@nativeamericacalling.com. And tomorrow, we're going to be back with a conversation about the best books by Native authors in 2020, also what to look forward to in publishing this year. I'm Tara Gatewood. We'll be right back.
Support by Navajo Language Renaissance, presenting Rosetta Stone Navajo for iPads, iPhones, Chromebooks, and Android devices with two learning levels and a self-correcting pronunciation feature. Info at NavajoRenaissance.org.
Native Teaching Aids collaborates with tribes to create games and apps which focus on language, culture, and history. Native Teaching Aids can create fun, engaging materials for your community. Further information and online store at NativeTeachingAids.com, who support this show.
Gugtas, do you have a health goal for 2021? Now is the perfect time to try something new and exciting to make your health a priority. Contact your local Indian health care provider for more information. Visit healthcare.gov or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.